welcome back to Main Engine Cutoff. I'm Anthony Colangelo. We're going to get started here in 2021 with a really fun show. It's been busy news out of China for the last several months with Chang'e 5 and a whole bunch of private companies starting up and a lot of plans for 2021. So I brought back our favorite guest about China, Andrew Jones. He's a writer for Space News, Space.com, a bunch of other outlets. And he is a fantastic guest to talk to about all things China. So I'm going to have him help me demystify some things going on. We're going to talk about Chang'e 5, going to talk about the commercial companies springing up in China, how all of that interacts. And I think you and I will both come away with more understanding of China's plans overall and the way that we should think about these things as we're reading them in the news. But before we get there, I want to say thank you to everyone out there who supports Main Engine Cutoff. We are sitting at 496 patrons of this show. We're almost to 500, so let's just get a couple more of you on there, get over that 500 number. It is the way that you support the show, entirely listener-funded. No ads, as you know, if you've listened before. No external funding. It's just from you. And this episode has been produced by 36 executive producers. Thanks to Brandon, Matthew, Simon, Lauren, Melissa, Chris, Pat, Matt, George, Ryan, Donald, Lee, Chris, Warren, Bob, Russell, Moritz, Joel, Jan, Grant, David, Eunice, Rob, Tim Dodd, the Everdashnaut, Frank, Julian, and Lars from Agile Space, Tommy, Matt, and 7 anonymous executive producers. Thank you all so much for making this episode possible. If you want to help get us over that 500 number and get an extra podcast in your life each week, head over there to mainenginecutoff.com/support. If you join up at the $3 a month level, you will get an extra show in your feed every week where I give you all the headlines of the week, talk about stories that don't quite make it here on the main show, but might still be interesting to follow along with. It's a great way to get some more podcasts in your life, stay up on space news, and support Miko. So thank you all so much for everyone that has headed over there already to support. And with that, let's give Andrew a call. Andrew Jones, welcome back to Main Engine Cutoff. Third time?
Third, I think.
So you've been busy for the past couple of months in terms of Chinese space ambitions. They've been quite busy, so I figured there's a couple different things I wanted to talk to you about. Number one, Chang'e 5 has been, now it's complete, and it's been kind of dominating the headlines from things that you're writing lately because it's such an important mission and turned out really successfully, which we'll talk about. And then we're getting into some really interesting time for the Chinese space program overall, where they're heading into this future plan that we've been hearing about for a couple of years now. They're kind of hitting, you know, a critical portion of that. And then recently there's been a lot of talk about private companies, commercial companies in China getting some big funding. And there's this crazy thing about commercial cargo, which we'll talk about. So I kind of want to just, you know, meander through that and have basically what this is that I have a lot of questions and you're the only person I know that can answer them. So welcome to Answering Anthony's Questions Hour.
Is this going to be quick fire or in depth?
I don't know. I have no idea. I'm just trying to figure some things out. So, you know. Well, first, let's talk about Chang'e 5. What is your overall take on that mission? It was a 23-day mission overall, launched to recovery of the samples. It seemed to go pretty flawlessly. Has there been anything that has come up since it got back that wasn't flawless, or was it perfect?
Almost perfect. Yeah, it was a tremendous mission. It was very intense to follow and try to work out when things are going to happen. Luckily, we had a leak on Chinese social media, which gave very accurate times for when these major mission events were going to take place. So after, I don't know, a few days, I think, like we saw this leak and we saw, oh, wow, these times actually match up with what's happened so far. So, yeah, that took a bit of the pressure and suspense off, but it was still, you know, waiting around for things to happen and then no live streaming and then waiting for China to say, yay, it was successful.
Well, so the no live streaming thing, that's the interesting part, right? They streamed the launch. They had quite grand coverage of the launch.
Yeah, and we were spoiled with the launch.
Yeah, we got spoiled with the launch, so we had expectations set. And then there was a stream up for the landing that they then pulled, you know, yeah, a couple minutes in. What do you make of all of that?
That kind of happens now and again. It's hard to say what goes on, but it would seem that maybe some higher up kind of gets nervous when it gets close to the time, because basically, I mean, China's space program is, you know, it's a national symbol. So they are very, very careful about anything looking bad. So it's, you know, kind of similar for NASA in a way, but it's, you know, a very different kind of media culture and control over the media and so on. So Yeah, so some people get nervous and then just like, no, it's just this is not happening. How did you think this is going to happen?
Right.
So it feels a bit like that. But yeah, very hard to know what's going
It's
on.
just weird to me that they did such big coverage of the launch, because it's not like if something went wrong in the landing, they could just say, we never launched a moon lander. Like, that was never a thing that we did. It's strange.
It's quite it's just very, very different. So in a unique political and cultural environment. So
I think we need to send some of the Boca Chica crew over to China and just have them post up somewhere. That sounds
yeah,
safe, right?
we settle their affairs first.
Yeah,
So
exactly.
yeah, I mean, like, this big it's a bit close to national security to be wanting to even think about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So the lander itself, I think what we've seen this year in terms of sample return missions, we've seen OSIRIS-REx gather too much sample from Bennu. We saw Hayabusa 2 come back with some samples from Ryugu, and then this was the other big sample return mission. It seemed to go, they got right about what the plans were for sampling, both through drill core and scooping. How do you, and then now they're going to kind of divvy these samples out, which seems to be a thing that they're saying. They're trying to use this as a soft power move, the way that NASA and Russia have in the past, where they're going to divvy these out to friendly nations. Has there been any thing that you've seen in terms of who's going to get these samples or what they're going to do with them?
Okay, so for a long time, because this mission was going to launch back in 2017 before the second Long March 5 failed. So they had been talking with the European Space Agency about collaborating on the science, and not just like giving a token amount of samples, but also working together on the analysis of these samples. But that kind of petered out and nothing's really happened. They started talking about this immediately after the samples were returned successfully and said, yes, we're working with the European Space Agency. But my understanding is from speaking to people that there hasn't been any new movement on this. So that seems like they were trying to use it for, for PR, for soft power, and say, well, look, we're willing to work with the European Space Agency. And, it's that might be targeted at someone across the Atlantic
Yeah,
or the
you think?
Pacific, depending away from your point of view. So yeah, that was an interesting thing. About the landing, just quickly. So the rendezvous and docking in orbit was the new thing there for China, as well as the liftoff from the moon. So so lifting off in a vacuum in a particular temperature environment, and also having no launch setup like you would back on Earth. And so those were the really big crucial parts of the mission. Everything else they'd kind of tested before. That was big. With the samples they got it was 1.731 kilos, and they were aiming for around 2 kilograms. So that sounds like they almost got everything they wanted. However, it turns out that they didn't get as much as they planned with the drill. So the breakdown was going to be 1.5 kilograms with scooping, and that the scooping actually went faster than planned. They took fewer scoops than planned to, get their allocation sorted. But with the drill, they hit some stones or slates beneath the ground, which they decided it's not worth trying to go through these and getting stuck or having a time delay and so on, because the time pressure on this stage of the mission was very tight, because the orbiter waiting in lunar orbit and so on, and the rendezvous window. So they decided to, okay, they got down to, I think, around about a meter rather than the 2 meters, and that would explain the shortfall from the 2 kilogram. So that didn't go, 100% according to plan. But otherwise, I mean, all these different things that which they pulled off was, very, very impressive.
Yeah, especially the rendezvous and docking portion, definitely, pushing not only autonomous work that they've been doing, but also being able to track all of that to the, very fine measurements that you need to be able to do that successfully, certainly says a lot for the future. And I think, I don't know how much this maps, but I remember early days there was a lot of talk about how the mission profile here is very similar to what an Apollo style lunar landing would be. Is there any indication that this really is a good kind of proof of concept for what they're planning for their future lunar plans, or is it too far out to really figure out how much of Chang'e 5 will carry over in terms of flight profile.
Yeah, it's a bit hard to say how much of this will, you know, go into the future larger plans. But yeah, it's certainly useful for those plans, which they certainly have. I mean, last year they launched the kind of prototype of a new generation crewed spacecraft on the Long March 5B, which was like a, you know, a test mission for the space station module launch. So they tested that like a boilerplate version. They're working on the Long March 9, which will be used for infrastructure for crewed lunar missions. They have a concept for, which would be like Long March 5 Heavy, or so-called 921 rocket, which takes the name from the kind of the code name for the Chinese human spaceflight plans. They have had some kind of proposals, like call for proposals for like lander concepts as well. So they're working on all the different moving parts, all the parts of the puzzle really for landing on the moon. So, you know, the fact that they went for this particular mission profile, you know, it's not, I don't think you can just write it off as a, you know, a coincidence or anything. The other thing it's useful for is the planned Mars sample return, mm-hmm. which they will be launching later this decade.
Yeah, it's easy to forget that they are coming up on the time when they're going to have a Mars lander as well that gets to orbit in, I think I saw, February?
The orbiter goes into, or should go into orbit on February 10. And then the landing should happen around May.
So they're doing Viking style, right? Where they hang out in orbit for a while and then go for their landing. So, I mean, that, like you're saying, this might have more implications for Mars sample return, which, aside from all of the human stuff that we'll talk about in a second, their timeline and NASA's timeline, or NASA and ESA's timeline, I should say, for Mars sample return lines up interestingly. NASA's going a three-mission style. I think China would do an all-in-one.
It might have changed. They were planning to do a single launch on the Long March 9, but then I think, and there hasn't been anything really official about this, but there's another concept which would be a Long March 5 and a Long March 3B. So, it's still, well, it probably has been decided by now, but last time I saw anything coming out of there, it looked like they had switched plans, so... So yeah, it's very, very hard to get anything new on that one. But that could be huge. Mars sample return would be huge. So it'd be interesting if they try and speed it up to try to compete with ESA and NASA. But let's see.
Yeah. So in terms of what we'll see this year, it seems to be that the space station plans that they have, where they're going to start launching this pretty soon here, is going to be the dominant story out of China for the year, aside from the Mars lander that we just talked about. But this is really a big focus this year. So where do plans currently sit? What kind of timeline should we expect for the rollout of this space station?
Okay, so the Long March 5B, which will be launching this core module, that is pretty much ready. There was a cargo ship on the Yangtze, which left port today, and it's heading to Tianjin up in the north, which is where the Long March 5B is, you know, manufactured and assembled and tested. So it may well be on the way to pick that up already and then deliver that to Wenchang in, say, no, that'll happen then in maybe within 2 weeks, let's say. So then it's usually around 2 months for Long March 5B, like the launch campaign. So we could see this launching in the second half of March already. And then that would be followed by a Tianzhou cargo and refueling mission. And then after that, the Shenzhou 12 crewed mission. So this, it looks like all of this is going to happen in the first half of this year. But they haven't given precise times because, well, they don't have to and they don't want to.
So they're going to launch the core module first, and they're going to start doing crewed missions before adding on too many modules, because they've got, I think, I forget the exact number of modules, but it's almost Mir-like in that it has, you know, what is it, three or four modules in the final plans for Tianyi 1?
Yeah, there's three modules, each around 20 tons, and there's a docking hub which is going up with this Tianhe core module. They're going to go... Yeah, this first crewed mission is going to go and, you know, check out the life support and robotic arm and so on. So check that everything's ready, spend a bit of time in orbit, and then they'll move on to these two experiment modules. This can be it could be expanded to up to six modules. There was a picture last year which kind of showed like two Tianhe core modules next to each other. So one could be like an engineering model. So it's kind of like the Chang'e missions, maybe, where they've got a backup for each one.
Interesting.
So if everything goes well, and especially if there was international interest, and I suppose that depends partly as well on the state of the, or the fate of the ISS, and if there are any other partners who would have money to spare, then yeah, they could be expanded.
One thing I'm curious about with the plans overall is that it seems like they're planning for a seriously increased rate of human launches as part of the space station program. Up until now, they've done one every handful of years. They haven't flown one since 2016, I want to say. And it was very sporadic for the first, you know, decade of crewed flights. Is there any indication as to is that something that we should be like keeping a close eye on, or do you think at this point they've flown enough flights that they can easily, considering the resources they're working with, step up to flying twice a year for the space station?
Yeah, I think so. What is it? Six missions altogether since 2003, which is, you know, nothing compared to Russia and the United States. However, what they've done is they've kind of pushed the envelope each time. So they've done, you know, single astronaut, then a crew of two, then spacewalks and so on, then three, and then what was it? Last time was a month, which was more than double their previous record. So they were each time pushing a bit. So they must be fairly confident that they are able to, you know, handle the ground operations and keep everything running smoothly. I think they've learned a lot through cooperation with Russia in particular. They also have agreements with countries like Italy as well, which will have helped. So it seems that they've just been happy to, you know, make steps each time rather than taking any risks or spending unnecessarily on this. So for a long time, people were wondering, okay, are they for real? Are they just trying to get into the ISS, and now that they can't, are they not bothering? But it just seems that they just take a different long-term approach rather than, having constant missions.
Now, you said something a second ago that I find interesting to pick your brain on about the space station plans internationally. They for a long time have worked with ESA, as you mentioned, on Chang'e 5, and then they've also sent some astronauts over to do training alongside the Taikonauts. There's an expectation, I think, that there would be an international participation element to the Chinese space station at some point. But you said, you know, if they find partners that have money to spare, that they might, you know, jump on something. We're seeing a fracturing of the International Space Station relationship, I think, between Russia and the NASA partners. There's been an increase of bickering, I would say, the last couple of years. ISS is starting to have random leaks and some issues that make me, at least, question the longevity of the ISS itself. It could be quite a shakeup the next couple of years. Russia doesn't exactly have the biggest budget in space. I assume that, you know, if they fall out of the ISS program, they would want to work with China at some point, because Russia's also looking for somebody that has some cash to spare. Is that something that's in the cards, or because Russia doesn't have any cash and China wants somebody with cash? How does that shake out there?
That's one of a number of things on the long list of questions I really want to investigate. That's not something I don't have much insight into what Russia's doing, so I haven't chased this up.
Yeah, but, so we're into Andrew's opinion time here.
A great question, and it's something that we've been seeing, especially with Trampoline Man on Twitter and so on. So, it's a very interesting question, and it's just something. All I can, from my point of view, it's something I'm very interested in watching, but I don't have any kind of insight at the moment as to what's going on. I mean, there are frequently China and Russia like to make statements on you know, oh, we're going to do something on the moon. And then 6 months, they'll say the same thing. And, you know, there's no added substance. But I haven't seen anything explicit about human spaceflight, I don't think, in that. So it's a possibility. But, yeah, I mean, there would be a number of stumbling blocks for that relationship as well. So it's, yeah.
And especially the thing that comes to mind for me is that Russia seems to be the fact that now, you know, the NASA partners are not going to be paying money for Soyuz launches is a pretty big sticking point, because that was a major source of funding for Roscosmos. If they are, you know, China's already got their own ride to their space station, what do they need the Soyuz for other than maybe an increased flight rate? You know, that could be something that is a poison pill of some sort for Russia to swallow, is that, oh, we're not actually going to be making money from them either. It could be, you know, in a weird spot overall. Yeah. The other side of it is ESA, right? How serious is that partnership where they were sending astronauts over to train? They're obviously working on Chang'e 5. Does that seem like something that ESA is doing because, you know, there's an available partner and they want to scale up their space operations? Or is it something that you would put a lot of weight in seeing that continue?
I think it's gone a bit quiet on that front. So with Chang'e 5, I mean, that was limited to ground station support. And then there was the discussion on the science and on the analysis side. And that didn't happen. So those are kind of separate from the human spaceflight thing. With approaching China with the idea of European astronauts going up to the Chinese space station, that was kind of... trying to keep options open, because NASA could be, you know, not the easiest of partners with regards to the International Space Station at times. But also it was, given how close those two partners are anyway, NASA and ESA, then they still had to have some kind of understanding going forward on why would that be smart and so on. So I think that there was some kind of understanding that that would give ESA an insight into China's operations, which would be beneficial to, you know, other parties who might not otherwise like that arrangement.
I like this theory.
but I think things have gone a bit quiet on that. With regards to a first visit to the Chinese space station, it might be something more political related to the Belt and Road Initiative. It could be Russia, depending on how things go. But as you say, there's, you know, neither of those countries would want to cede the, you know, the kind of
prestige,
the role of performing the launches and being, you know, yeah, responsible for everything like that. So China likes to say basically that, look, this space station's open to everyone across the world, right? But they're not letting anyone in to the, you know, the core parts of this project. So it's not like the ISS where everyone, you know, people have these different partners have, you know, crucial roles in the project. It's, you know, China likes to be in control of everything. So,
yeah. And certainly when you consider the future of partnerships, the flight opportunity side on NASA's side have greatly increased now that commercial crew is flying. So if you're ESA and you're interested in getting your astronauts to space, there's a lot more seats available over here right now. And I do like your theory that ESA's going to scoop out, you know, what's going on over here? And let's see. And then maybe NASA, because NASA can't talk to China, is like, hey, what did you, how was your trip? How did everything go over there? I like that theory a little bit. It's just interesting to consider, you know, how these partners lean on each other in terms of, well, you know, we're going to the moon, so only a couple spots available. It'd be a shame if, you know, we flew a couple more Canadians or something, because you're obviously booked up with China over there. It seems like there's a lot of, you know, potential conflict. And really, I think that just speaks to the amount of shakeup that we could see in the next decade here as everyone's plans move on and diverge. It's just a fun time to watch all this.
Yeah, I mean, and we just had a very, well, the election was, you know, it, I suppose you could think of it coming down to a few thousand votes in a few places. And then if you look, there would probably have been a change of administrator, even if the incumbent had won, and their approach, you know, the America First kind of line of approach, that would, you know, could that have led to a point, especially with the Artemis Accord and so on, of the US saying, look, you either deal with us or you deal with China, mm-hmm. and there's no in between. So that would have put ESA and Russia in quite a position.
I think the quote that you're looking for is, you're either with us or against us. I think that's the quote you're looking for.
Going back a bit further, yes, that's it, yeah. These things can turn quite quickly, and there's lots of things going on in the background, so it's fascinating times, as you say.
The one last thing that I want to dig into is a bit of a broader topic about the, and we'll start on the government side, but I want to talk about the organizations and companies within China that are working in space. Because I think from the outside, it's easy to see this as an entire, like a single, you know, monolith. I just want to understand the relationship a bit, especially with regards to things like the space station. They have these plans for future missions to take humans to the moon. They've got the Chang'e missions, and then they have the space station missions alongside all of their satellite launches that they do every other day, basically, it seems like. The architecture there, you know, what is the division between those various projects? Does work on the space station delay human launches to the moon? Are they distinct entities? Could you give us kind of a high-level view of how we should think about these different tracks of work?
No.
Please demystify all of China for us.
Yeah, I can try to, you know, give some kind of insight here. So people like to talk about CNSA, right, as some kind of analog to NASA, but it really doesn't work like that. Think of CNSA as like the international kind of front office for China's space activity. So they go and show up at different places and say, you know, we represent China. But they aren't, apart from maybe in some lunar exploration areas, robotically, they're not really that involved. So the China Aerospace Science and Technology Corporation, CASC, that's like the main space contractor, but also kind of a bit like a space agency in its own right. It has to follow what the Chinese Communist Party tells it to do. It's overseen by the Chinese government and has to follow orders and so on, but also has some kind of leeway itself. It's state-owned rather than, you know, clearly state-run. So that's the main space contractor. It has eight major institutes, and they have loads of subsidiaries which are dedicated to all kinds of aspects of the space program. So the Chinese space program, Chinese space station modules, for example, they are being developed and manufactured by the China Academy of Space Technology. There's going to be lots of names which sound the same here.
I think that's the one that annoys me most, because you have CASC and CAST, and that one annoys me.
Yeah, this is CAST, which is like the fifth institute of CASC, and they're a major satellite maker, and they make spacecraft, they make the Shenzhous, they make, you know, all the major kind of things like this. So they made the Tianzhou cargo craft as well. I think what you referred to in the introduction to this was the a few days ago there was a call from the China Manned Space Agency, the China's, you know, human spaceflight agency, which is kind of overseen by the military to make things a little bit more complicated as well. So they put out a call for proposals for low-cost transportation for cargo to the space station, and that's open to everyone connected to CASC, which we just talked about, but also to other actors. And that would bring in CASIC, which is like a sister conglomerate to CASC. And they're like a defense contractor, a missile maker, and so on. They have Kuizhou solid rockets. It also turns out that they're looking, I think, was it a Methalox rocket? So they've suddenly turned to liquids as well. Mm-hmm. They have plans to launch their own constellation of satellites. They have their own space plane in the works, which is not the same thing as we think was launched in September. That was what we think would be some kind of fixed wings reusable spacecraft tested by CASC, but we really don't know because we didn't see anything. And also that would bring in this kind of nascent private or commercial sector, which would include iSpace, land space, galactic energy and so on. So they would be able to get involved in this. But at the moment, they wouldn't be able to do this in terms of capabilities and resources and expertise and so on. So that's not really possible. But it's notable that they've made this call and made it open, because China's major space projects have been like CASC only. They've been, you know, they're the main space contractor. They develop and deliver all of these things. Going back to, was it late 2014 when they opened up the space sector to private capital? It was supposed to be like small satellites and small launches. And the idea, the thinking was that they could only compete for commercial contracts. But this would suggest that going forward, even though now it's probably not going to happen, but going forward, there will be opportunities for these companies. If they can prove themselves to be capable, then they could get involved in some of the government side of things. So anyway, so where were we? Yeah, so that was, so CASC is kind of like the main traditional space player. And then you have these emerging companies. So KASIC would be a major one, because they are huge state-owned enterprise and they're in the Fortune 500 group. They have, you know, lots of resources and money. A smaller player would be the Chinese Academy of Sciences. They have they've been doing sounding rockets, and they've been making Beidou satellites, some of the Beidou satellites which are in orbit. So after this kind of opening of the space sector, some of their employees have left to start up their own companies. So one example would be Space T, which is a satellite platform maker based in Hunan province. And they actually now are working on their own constellation of low Earth orbit radar remote sensing satellites. So a bit,
yeah,
like
they released an image of one of theirs. Was it last week or something?
Yeah, so they're kind of the Chinese version, following the footsteps of Capella and
ICI. I don't know how to say that company.
ICI, yeah. ICI, so yeah. Which is just a few miles away from me, so I really shouldn't have been so slow. What else? But there is actually a launch company spin-off called CASSpace, or Jonker, I think. And they plan to launch a first rocket, I think, in September. So I think that was going to be a solid rocket, and that would actually be a larger solid rocket than anything that CASC or KASIC have got so far. So that's come kind of a bit out of nowhere.
That's interesting, yeah, because a lot of the launch companies, I feel like the first launches certainly looked a lot to me, I don't know the relationship here, but it looked a lot to me like they were using all of these solid boosters that came from the government launch side, and then they declared these commercial launches, even though I don't know if they were directly transferred, but it kind of read like that to me. Like, you know, if the U.S. wanted to say, now we have commercial launchers, and they just took a bunch of solid boosters in the Air Force arsenal and said, launch some satellites.
Well, they did that, right?
They did that back then, right? So is that where we're at with these early launches from the commercial companies in China?
It's a bit like that. So I was talking about CASC. So a lot of these companies will have had employees from CASC leave to set up their own companies, sometimes with the help from people on the outside, maybe from finance and so on. Like in the example of land space. So think about all this opening of the space sector is kind of like looking at what America's doing and realizing that there's a lot of opportunities for innovation and driving down costs and also setting up new supply lines and actually following the Trump administration's kind of tariffs and kind of the trade war. I think that that's affected China's supply chains in some regards. So they were kind of thinking ahead, maybe, or just, you know. So basically, this is part of a national strategy. It's not just saying, oh, well, we should have private companies as well and let them go and do what they want. It's a lot more calculated than that. They want to develop kind of their space sector and have a thriving space economy in China. So a lot of people think, oh, well, they're going to, you know, they're going to cheat on pricing and so on, and that's going to impact competition globally and so on. But it's I see it more of at the moment, certainly in terms of just developing the kind of access to space in China, in fostering innovation, driving down costs, and just making a more healthy and robust space industry. So maybe the, for now at least, the international competition side is not such a large part of this.
Yeah, and that's something that I think comes to mind a lot. You know, people that listen to this show probably think, how much do these things interact with the industry that we already know? Because certainly from the US, you see a lot of people going over to India to fly on PSLV or something like that, getting good deals. There's been a lot of talk about how that is a major source of competition, especially in the small sat space. But then, yeah, in the Chinese launcher side, how many of their payloads could be international? How many of their payloads? Obviously, we don't see many payloads or any payloads flying on U.S. rockets today, and I would expect vice versa. But then there's that middle ground, right? Through European companies, could they go over there? And they certainly, you know, can. They have access, more access to the market than a U.S. company does these days. So you expect it more to be an inward-looking thing for the first, I don't know, first couple years before they start looking outward for payloads?
Yeah, they have been open to international payloads, but of course you have ITAR, which makes, you know, transferring anything that you want to launch to China for a launch very difficult. So Satellogic, which is based in Argentina, they've been able to do this. So it's possible, and there are actors developing like ITAR-free technologies, so-called ITAR-free, to kind of get around this kind of barrier. But that's still a big barrier. Actually, CASC, they offer kind of turnkey solutions, so they'll go to a country with a delegation, and they'll offer launch services. They'll make the satellite. They'll, you know, do all the ground segment stuff, training, everything. So they kind of get around ITAR by doing that as well, and being part of the kind of Chinese diplomacy things as well. So just going back to what you asked before, with the, you know, how close are these things? It can be hard to say. And I don't want to make it sound too monolithic, because I said this is part of a national strategy. But within that, you have companies which clearly have their own aims and they want to do things. But they would still be overseen by a government group called SASTIND, which would, you know, have to approve first they're being set up, and then also approve transfer technology. So as you said, it looked like, you know, this was like a contractor providing certain things to a launch company and then launching it. But you can kind of see, at least ostensibly from the updates which were coming in the months and years before these launches, that these companies were developing apparently their own rocket motors and so on, and doing all these different tests. So they would have had technology and expertise transferred from CASC, for example, but then they're also doing their own work. But then if you look at some of the photos and some of the kind of the dimensions of a rocket, for example, so you'll find rocket diameters which are very similar to Dongfeng missiles and existing Long March rockets. So, you know, they're borrowing a lot of things from some of these existing launches, but then trying to develop their own supply chains and find innovations where they can, and then also go their own way. So I think one thing to watch this year will be Landspace will be making probably the first Methalox orbital launch attempt, which is going to be quite a big thing. So they, I think there was an IAC in like 2015 or something like this, where there was like China saying, look, we've got this Methalox rocket. And now you're seeing, you know, these companies developing their own Methalox engine. So then there's companies developing Methalox engines. So, you know, we know where this kind of technology is coming from, but they've been kind of given some measure of freedom to go and work on those themselves. So it's kind of and the other thing would be to look at the funding. There's been lots of funding around, particularly last year, lots of money going into these Chinese companies on the satellite side and the launcher side. But if you look at these, sometimes they will be kind of investment funds which are linked to, say, the Chinese Academy of Sciences or something, to a nationally controlled kind of financial group or something like this. So yeah, it's not like the US investment environment or anything like that, and the space sector is still very new and it's needing a lot of support also getting support from provincial governments and things like this. So this is, yeah, it's a very complex kind of set of dynamics.
Yeah, especially on the front that you're talking about there with the funding. We've seen funding rounds recently for the Jilin 1 constellation. I think SpaceD got some funding recently as well on the satellite side. So that's the big mystery to me, is like how should I look at these private companies that are raising a bunch of money, but the money's coming from, you know, state controlled funds? Do they have the kind of freedom to expand their capabilities, or is it something that is very directed from a top down kind of mechanism?
Yeah, it's hard to say, and you have to go case by case. And there have been, I honestly just cannot remember. Chang'e 5 has fried my brain, and there's just so many companies going on. But there has been, like, notably funding rounds where it's like, oh, hold on, that's like the Chinese kind of branch of a US investment fund and things like this. So it's certainly not all nationally driven. But that's something that you have to be aware of, that it's not too far away from the Chinese defense sector,
yeah,
at any point. So,
and certainly, to use a recent news story, even Jack Ma is not exactly out there living it up right now. So even when you have tens of billions of dollars to your name, who knows what can go on? So I assume, you know, the companies probably aren't. They probably can't wheel and deal like we're seeing down in Boca Chica, as we mentioned earlier. That's not something that we're going to see happening in China anytime soon.
Yeah, that's a good point. And also, as you mentioned, Jack Ma, then the other thing is that when are those companies like Alibaba Group and Tencent going to get involved as well? I think Tencent have been investing in Satellogic. And then there's also car companies which are getting involved in, I think they're looking at GNSS enhancement satellites in low Earth orbit, things like that, to help with, driverless cars, things like this. So there's still a lot of potential for, outside investments, say, outside from these actors and from the government, which we talked about. But then also at the moment, it seems that Xi Jinping is very much trying to rein in the private sector and get more state control. So there's lots of different kind of dynamics again. And it's, yeah.
So you're saying you'll be very busy this year is what you're saying.
Yeah, I dread to think, to be honest. But yeah, it's a good thing. It's all very interesting. And I just have to make sure that I get some breaks in there.
So, yeah, for sure. So
yeah, I ended up not having so much of a summer holiday, and then by the end of like Chang'e 5, it was like, oh my god. So yeah, it's going to be a very interesting year. The CASC is aiming for over 40 launches. KSIC will be launching lots of Kuiper satellites. There's other spin-off launches as well. But then the private sector, there's going to be lots of hop tests and orbital launch attempts.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's going to be the busiest year by far, it seems.
So where should people, if they're not already following you, where should they go to keep up with what you're working on, what you're writing, and all of that?
You can go to AJ_FI. On Twitter. I write for Space News most regularly as a correspondent. I also contribute at different places, such as IEEE Spectrum, Sky and Telescope, National Geographic, and other places. Twitter's where I dump everything that's kind of going on, or that's kind of, spill over as well. So
that's why you were one of my picks on Off Nominal not too long ago. Is your Twitter feed is literally, if I'm like, I wonder what's going on in China, AJ_FI, that's where I'm headed.
Wonderful. Thanks, man.
Well, thank you so much for hanging out. I feel like I've demystified some of the things that I've been wondering, so I'm sure everyone out there listening as well has. So thanks again, and hopefully it's not so long before I talk to you the next time.
Yeah, sounds good.
Thanks again to Andrew for coming on the show. It is always a pleasure talking with him, and it helps me understand a lot of what's going on in the Chinese space world. So if you appreciated this show, head over to Twitter at AJ_FI. Let him know that he is the best as he is. And until next time, that is all I've got for you today. Head over to managingcutoff.com/support once again if you want to get that headlines feed and help support the show. And if you've got any questions or thoughts, hit me up, anthony@managingcutoff.com or on Twitter @WeHaveMiko. And until next time, I'll talk to you soon.